Hey, Jason, just wanted to send you a quick message of gratitude. I woke up this morning to all of the panic in the stock market, seeing that the market was down 1,000 points and CNBC was getting me all worked up. And then I realized, wait, I'm not in that game. I'm in the real estate game. And I just, even with its challenges, I'm so grateful that I got into the game and got in with properties that make sense because the rent income keeps coming in and real estate is certainly not a perfect investment, but I'll tell you what, I don't wake up in panic because I just lost thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars pretty much overnight, which I know a lot of people did. So thank you. Glad we connected. And I'm glad to be in the income property game instead of the Wall Street game for my future.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show with Jason Hartman. You're about to learn a new slant on investing, some exciting techniques, and fresh new approaches to the world's most historically proven asset class that will enable you to create more wealth and freedom than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine self-made multimillionaire who's actually been there and done it. He's a successful investor, lender, developer, and entrepreneur who's owned properties in 11 states, had hundreds of tenants and been involved in thousands of real estate transactions. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to your financial independence day. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
Welcome to episode number 1397, and I am here with George Gammon, coming to you from Medellin, Colombia. I still want to say Medellin.
I say Medellin.
You say Medellin.
Yeah.
And they haven't labeled you as a total gringo and run you out of town? No?
Well, they've labeled me. They just haven't run me out of town.
Oh, okay. Got it.
At least not yet.
Yeah. Well, hey, George, I had you on the show the other day, and you know, it's been great spending 5 days here in Medellin. Mm-hmm. And I got to say, I am so pleasantly surprised. This is a delightful place. You know, I grew up as a kid hearing about the Medellin cartel and all of these terrible things. I saw movies with Chuck Norris and getting rid of the drug smugglers and all this kind of stuff. This place is charming. I mean, you got incredible restaurants, artistic architecture, artistic food, people that are exceptionally nice and helpful.
Yeah.
You know, I remember years ago when I was like 22 years old and I went to Europe for the first time as an adult. I was born in Europe. But I remember the Italians were always super helpful. Mm. Those were like the really helpful people, and the French that were like, get out of here. You know, they didn't care about you. But the Colombians are just so nice and so helpful. You know, when I'm struggling reading something, they just come up and said, can I help you? You know, with Spanish, and really, really pleasant surprise. But since this show is about real estate investing in economics, we talked a little bit about your real estate deals in the US and here in Colombia. And I got to thinking, and we talked about this a little bit the other day, about inflation. And of course, South America and Central America has been infamous for their terrible inflation disasters, right?
Yeah.
You know, I sent you over a chart this morning that's pretty interesting. And we were talking about how the humble peso, and by the way, since I have some here, we might as well just pull them out of the wallet.
Yeah, take the 50 right there.
Yeah. That's so, so this is 50 pesos.
No, 50,000.
Oh, this is 50. Yeah. Well, this is 50 mil pesos.
Yeah, 50,000.
So that's 1,000. Okay. Mm-hmm. So this ain't worth very much, is it?
About 15 bucks.
$15 or so. Mm-hmm. Now, you can always, well, it gives you a hint at least. When you're looking at any currency, if it's denominated in really high numbers, you just have to think that when they created that currency, a single unit, a single peso, must have had, I don't know, roughly the equivalent of like the concept of a dollar, I guess.
Yeah, well, they didn't have that many zeros to begin with.
Right, yeah.
It's not like they started and saying, well, what should our main, you know, what should the main number be? Let's start
1
with 50,000.
Pesos or 50,000. Yeah, no.
We just like zeros.
Right. That's my point, though, right? Is that it's just a clue that there must have been rampant inflation in that country, right?
That's right.
Looking back, just let's look at that chart for a moment.
Yeah, I don't know if we can pull it up on the screen there.
This is primitive, but now there's your chart, okay? This is from ColumbiaReports.com, I believe is the website.
Mm-hmm.
But George, inflation rates of 30 to 40%, here in the past. Yeah. What are your thoughts about that? And, you know, just anything you want to say to our listeners about inflation in general? Do you agree with Milton Friedman that it's always a monetary phenomenon?
No.
No. Okay. Tell us about that.
No, because there's, I think you can disprove that pretty easily, especially with what we've had since 2008, because they've increased the money supply incredibly. I mean, if you look at a chart of M2, it's just unbelievable. I mean, it's hockey stick.
Right.
From left to right.
So a lot of money's been created, mm-hmm. and we've had some inflation, but it isn't in balance with the money creation.
So there's two components there. Friedman got it right. It is about money, but it's also about velocity.
Okay.
He thought velocity was consistent.
Right. And so if velocity is low, even if money creation is high, mm-hmm. since it's not moving through the economy, mm-hmm. you don't get a high inflationary effect.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I always just use a very simple example and say, let's just pretend that you or the Fed printed $1 trillion and just stuffed it under your mattress.
Right.
We're not going to have price inflation because the money is under your mattress.
It's not circulating in the broader economy.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's just in your closet or buried in your backyard. Or
So that example, sure. But what have they done? I mean, is it still hanging at the banks and it's not trickling down, if you will, to use a well-worn cliche?
Yes. So that's the easiest way that I can explain that is that there's two different economies. There's a financial economy and there's the real economy.
Right.
And the way that you would have to get velocity, or the only way to really get velocity up, is through the real economy. Mm-hmm. So what the Fed does is it increases their balance sheet, basically it prints money, it creates it out of thin air. It creates reserves, and those reserves are held with the Fed at the bank accounts of the member banks.
Right.
That's their, the member banks, like a, it's called a JP Morgan.
Right. They have their own bank account and they're just sitting
the
on
Fed,
the money. Right?
At the Fed. Yeah. Right. So it's their reserves. Mm-hmm. So then what happens, let's use Wells Fargo, Bank of America as an example. So you bank with B of A. Mm-hmm. I'm with Wells Fargo. I write you a check. And let's say it's a check for 10 grand. And then that 10 grand would go, the Fed would move that from Wells Fargo's reserve account to B of A's reserve account to match up the deposit.
Right.
So on our end, the consumer end, it's a deposit or a bank liability.
Right.
And on the side of the banks, on the back end, that just goes, that's a liability of the Federal Reserve. That's technically an asset of the bank on their balance sheet. So that 10,000 would go from the reserve account of Wells Fargo to Bank of America's reserve account. So that's happening on the back end there. So they could print 20. Go ahead.
One thing I just want to say, you know, just remember from a bank's perspective, it's opposite of the way we think of it. Mm-hmm. When a bank has a deposit, that's a liability to the bank.
Right.
When they make a loan, that's an asset to the bank. We think of it the opposite way. So yeah. I just wanted to go ahead.
Yeah, but what's really interesting is, and this is probably a topic for a completely different discussion, but when they create a loan, they also create a deposit at the same time. So technically, the deposits are created by loans, by debt.
Money is lent into existence, which is a very far-flung idea that is really hard to get your head around.
But yeah, it
is. Maybe that's a... That's like three more episodes we got to do on that. That's a big one.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
So what happens is the Fed, if they created $20 trillion and just had it in reserves and excess reserves, then that's really not going to get out. That's under your mattress because it's held at the Fed. It's not into the system.
It's not in the economy.
Yeah. Going back to our earlier point, in order to get that into the economy, the retail banks would have to increase retail lending, car loans, home loans, et cetera. And that's what would get it into the real economy. But then people would have to spend it faster to increase that velocity. So is that going to happen? Is it not? That depends on demographics. It depends a lot on psychology. Mm-hmm. There's multiple variables.
Consumer confidence, the wealth effects. Yeah, a lot of things going on.
Absolutely. Yeah, but it has to go from the financial economy into the real economy.
Right.
And the only transmission mechanism that they currently have is retail lending.
Right.
So if there's no retail lending, it really doesn't matter how much money they print. It typically won't show up too much in the CPI.
Okay. So the inflation doesn't happen unless that money gets into the retail sector. You talked about the financial economy and the real economy. I sometimes refer that as to, you know, Wall Street versus Main Street. Yeah. You know, there's two economies.
Absolutely.
And this is why the distribution of wealth becomes very, you know, you have a lot of favorites, right?
Absolutely.
The rich, the banksters, the Wall Street class, they've benefited from all of this. And it hasn't trickled down to the Main Street economy where Joe Sixpack lives. So it's a really unequal distribution, isn't it?
I would say it's even more perverse than that, because Joe Sixpack or Joe Retiree is going to make a lot more money if interest rates are at 6% than at 0%.
Okay. Yep.
Because they're not making any money on their savings. And what most people don't think about, the interest rates right now in the United States are negative in real terms.
Right.
So if you
after inflation and taxes.
That's right. So if you're a saver and you've had this plan for the last 30 years to retire.
And you did the right thing. You saved.
You did the right
thing. You delayed gratification. Mm-hmm. It's totally unfair to older people.
Yeah, because and then they're basing their number on, let's say, a 7% return on their money. Mm-hmm. That's how they're going to have enough money to retire. Right. Well, if they're only, for the last 15 years, if they're only getting 0% or 1% or 2%, then and that's compounded. Mm-hmm. That means there's a lot less there for retirement. And so they're actually going to end up spending less money, taking out less debt, and therefore that decreases velocity even further. Yeah. So it's one of those unintended consequences where the Fed's trying to increase inflation by dropping interest rates low, and they're actually doing the opposite.
Yeah. So what can our listeners do? what can people do to help themselves? It's so unfair that retirees are having to invest in speculative things and risky things.
Yeah, they go for the risk curve.
They should be able to do laddered CDs and bonds.
They should be able to just own treasuries and
treasuries and retire and get the benefits of all the fruits of their labor for the last many decades.
And we haven't even gone into insurance companies or pension funds either, which they're technically savers. So if the pension funds, if the pension funds, they make the promises to the people, well, those promises are predicated upon 7% return.
Mm-hmm.
And those pension funds haven't got even close to that.
And we have a global pension crisis.
That's
I mean, it's not just an Illinois and California thing.
Yeah, it's everywhere.
It's not just a U.S. thing. It's an every country problem.
Right. So you force those pension funds to go further out the risk curve.
Yeah.
So if we have a recession, which eventually we will, then they're not only not going to get that 7%, they're going to get crushed because they took on too much risk. And however much they're short now, they're going to be even more short. So let's say they're 50% funded.
Mm-hmm.
That means you are getting 50% of your pension that you expect. Well, that's most likely going to be a lot less when we hit the next recession, because they've had to take on so much more risk. As an example, instead of just going into treasuries, now they go into junk debt.
Yeah,
like junk corporate
junk bonds or derivatives, like the Orange County tax assessor was investing in the mid 90s, Bob Citron. It's a famous, you know, Orange County where I lived at the time declared bankruptcy.
Or they'll invest in private equity. They'll invest in like SoftBank, and then SoftBank takes that pension money, and invests it in WeWork.
Yeah,
if you want to call it an investment.
WeWork was a joke from the beginning.
Well, it's not as much of a joke as their other companies. Did you hear about WAG?
No, I don't even know WAG. What's WAG?
Okay, so WAG was another brainchild of SoftBank.
Okay.
And that was a dog walking app.
Oh, yes. I know WAG. Yes. Because I actually used it as a consumer.
But So all it is just an app where you find someone to walk your dog.
Right. It's a sharing economy concept where you just get freelancers to just.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So SoftBank invested $300 million into that. $300 million.
You could build an app like that for far less than $300 million.
Right.
Yeah. That's insane. Yeah. This is just.
And obviously, that investment hasn't gone well. They've taken a huge haircut on WeWork. And that's all pension. Not all, but that's a lot of that could be your pension money.
Okay. So pensions, insurance companies.
Yeah. Insurance companies, because that's how they're going to make a lot of their money, is by taking all those premiums and what they don't have to pay back out. You know, they invest that. That's Warren Buffett.
Right.
And then you get that return. Well, if interest rates are zero or even negative, then that's going to force all those insurance companies to go out of business, along with the banks. I mean, there's just, and oddly enough, if the banks go out of business, then they're going to lend less, which again goes back
contracts to the economy even more,
and the money supply and velocity.
Right.
And it's just, the economy is an extremely complex system. It's got billions of variables and billions of transactions on a daily basis. it's just like the weather. Mm-hmm. One way I look at it is you always hear those stories like in Florida or Australia where they've got a problem with, like, let's call it insects. Mm-hmm. They've got too many mosquitoes.
Right.
So they introduced some frog from India
to eat the mosquitoes.
Right. And, yeah, and in 2 years, they've got a way worse frog problem than they had an insect problem. Then they bring in otters or whatever to eat the frogs, and that creates an even bigger problem.
It's a kicking the can down the road problem. Right?
Yeah, but each time they kick that can down the road, it
becomes a bigger problem.
Yeah. Typically exponentially.
Yeah, right. With all this in mind, what can people do? You know, we're not going to influence or change the powers that be.
Right.
They're way too powerful. They have their own agenda. What should we do as individuals?
I think the easiest thing you can do is if you own a home, make sure that you've got a fixed rate mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
That's number one. That's something easy. There's no excuse not to have that.
Right.
I also like people to have a little bit of gold just as an insurance policy.
Mm-hmm.
I like to have some diversification, but I'm not sure that everyone can do that. Let's see, what else can everyone do? Also, I think educate yourself.
Yeah.
Understand what's going on. You talk about a lot of the macro stuff on your show, which I think is really important.
And so do you. Yes. They're
yeah.
Great.
But I mean, you've got a real estate driven show and you're still talking about macro. Mm-hmm. And that's really, really important. Mm-hmm. I think maybe some other real estate investing podcasts might get kind of myopic and what they're talking about. And you know what I've noticed with real estate investors is they're very good at bottoms up analysis,
mm-hmm.
but they're horrible at tops down.
Like they almost completely
ignore it.
Yeah. What's that mean? Explain that a little bit.
So I won't mention any, there's some online forums that are very popular I like a lot.
Right. Yeah.
But you go on there and see what these pros and these real estate investing experts are talking about. And it's always bottoms up stuff. It's always about, well, this neighborhood and this, you know, the population is increasing coming in, or this zoning law is changing, or it's always,
or I got a great deal,
structure this deal and all these things.
Yeah.
But then they completely ignore the Federal Reserve. They ignore interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
They like the interest rates when they're talking about, you know, how much it's going to cost me to finance, but they never consider, okay, our interest rate cycles as an example.
Sure.
So if you go back to the 1700s, you can see that the interest rates in the United States have run in cycles about 20 to 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now we're 40 years into the last down cycle in interest rates starting in 1981.
Okay.
So if history repeats itself, and I'm not saying that it will, but the probability is pretty high that at some point in time, we're going to have another interest rate cycle that goes back up.
Yeah.
So most real estate experts, as an example, probably don't even know that
they're not even thinking about that macro picture.
Yeah,
absolutely. That's a good point. And if and when we have that up cycle, all of those fixed rate mortgages that are in the hands of investors now will become a much more valuable asset because they won't be able to duplicate them. Anybody coming into the game after you, if you got one of those fixed rate mortgages, they won't be able to get it.
Correct.
So they will either not buy the property, which means a shortage in housing supply, if there's fewer buyers, investor buyers, a shortage in rentals, or they have to pay a higher rate. So they can't compete with you as effectively as offering their property for rent in the marketplace, right?
Yeah. And especially if it's due to inflation, if interest rates are going up as a result of inflation, or higher inflation expectations, which would be most likely. I mean, we didn't talk about it, but the Fed has discussed pegging the yield curve like they did back in the World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're doing that, then they're going to let inflation run hot. And that's just another reason to have that fixed rate mortgage, because inflation, if it exceeds the interest rate that you are paying, that's a transfer of wealth from the lender to the borrower.
Yep.
So you have to ask yourself, okay, if I can get a mortgage right now at 3.5%, let's just call it that.
Yeah. And you can.
Okay. So 3.5%, then you've got to ask yourself, okay, what is the real rate of inflation?
Right.
And taking it to a more granular level, what is the real rate of rent inflation?
Right.
Because I think that's another thing, that even if real estate investors do look at it from a macro perspective, they just look at inflation in general
versus rent inflation.
But it's really about rent inflation.
That's a good point.
Because you're using rent to pay the mortgage.
Right. Sure.
So it's really the differential between the rental rates and the mortgage that you're paying that is a fixed cost.
Right.
So even if CPI is going up at 3%, but if rents are going up at 6%, then there's that differential. Then that's going to be that transfer of wealth, because you're paying that loan back with fewer dollars or devalued dollars relative to the rent that you're paying.
That's fantastic. I got to ask you, what does George Gammon think the rate of real inflation is? I mean, you know, the government will tell us it's give or take 2% most of the time. Yeah. What do you think the real rate is? Of course, all my listeners know that it's manipulated in three ways: weighting, substitution, and hedonic indexing. What do you think the real rate is? Or you're a shadow stats guy. You like John Williams' work, right?
I do. Yeah. I do. I love it. But that would imply that they measured it correctly in the 70s.
Fair enough. Yeah. To have a reference point, a base.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't think that they can measure inflation effectively. It's just impossible. There's too many components to it. So if I had to throw out a number just on what I see when I'm not in the States much, but you know, when I go to Chipotle when I'm in the States or I look at my health insurance or the cost of XYZ, I think compound, it's got to be going up at north of 5%. I'd say at least 6-7%. Yeah.
So interestingly, that math, we talked about the 3.5% mortgage. If you borrow at 3.5%, even if you're paying the debt yourself and there's no renter ever, and you get to deduct that interest, and just for ease of numbers, let's say your combined state and federal tax rate is 50% because it's easy. That's 1.75% tax deduction. So you're really only paying 1.75%. And if inflation is 5, wow, that's a phenomenal deal without ever renting your property.
Yeah.
Without even producing any income.
Yeah. There's a lot. If you know what you're doing, there's a lot of advantages to real estate. Unfortunately, people think they just use that as a one size fits all. Like, as an example, if you like Little Rock and I like Kansas City, well, that means that if I buy in LA, well, I'm making the same decision as George and Jason.
You're definitely not.
You know, because I'm buying real estate and they just, they don't understand. And then also, too, I think it's going back to what we were saying with education. It's important that even if you're a person that's a small time investor, maybe you want to buy a couple properties from your network, that you still listen to your podcast and understand what's going on with quantitative easing, the Fed.
The macro picture.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely. Very important. Good stuff. George, tell us where they can find your YouTube channel.
George Gammon is my name, or georgegammon.com. And George is typical spelling. Gammon is G-A-M-M-O-N.
Excellent. George Gammon, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Grow smart, not big. One of the things that small business owners become quickly addicted to is the notion of growth. After all, the reason why most of us go into business in the first place is to make our mark on the world with a thriving, successful business. Now, to the entrepreneur, there is little in life that's more exciting than finding new business deals, building new relationships, and growing your business from a small fledgling startup into a strong pillar of the community. What frequently gets lost in this scramble for success, though, is the ultimate goal that you're aspiring to achieve. For most business people, that goal is wealth and the time to enjoy life. Many entrepreneurs grow their way into wealth, but find that the more their business grows, the less time they have to enjoy anything. Now, the reason for this is because larger businesses have more problems to solve. More customers mean more decision makers to please, more deals to renegotiate, and more times that issues need to be smoothed over if something doesn't go according to plan. The trap that many business people fall into is that they start their business by doing everything themselves, and then continue to do everything themselves until they are so stressed out that a nervous breakdown ensues. In most cases, the root of this problem comes from a fundamental misunderstanding of what business owners are attempting to achieve. Many think that the goal is to achieve more revenue, but the real goal is to achieve more economic freedom. There are two fundamental elements that make up economic freedom. One is money, and the other is time. Now, both are necessary to live your dreams, and neither is sufficient without the other. The problem that's created by growth obsession is that a business will expand its way into lots of money, but will do so by dominating all of the owner's time. This apparent paradox is the exact opposite of economic freedom. Instead of building the money and time to follow your dreams, you've built a steady stream of money that requires you to constantly invest all of your time in order to keep it flowing. The alternative to this model is growing smart instead of growing big. The difference between growing big and growing smart is one of paradigms. The way that your paradigms are shaped will determine how your business grows. Consider the paradigm difference between growing big and growing smart. First, growing big. You increase revenue as fast as possible by finding deals and growing production. Income per year of work is what matters. You say, I need to spend time managing and growing my business, or I need every customer that I can get. Expansion is how I will grow revenue. I don't trust anybody else to run my business the right way. And without my constant effort, this business will fail. Let's compare that to growing smart, where you increase revenue through innovations that allow you to become more efficient and spend less time earning your next dollar of income. And income per hour of work rather than year of work is what matters. You say, I need to eliminate the aspects of my business that waste time but don't produce income. And I focus on customers that produce the most value for my business. Also, expansion only makes sense if my systems are already automated. You decide, I must trust somebody else to run my business the right way. And a business that requires my constant effort isn't one that I want to run. You see, in the end, growth is what fuels business. It's the reason why you ventured out from the apparent safety of employment to create an enterprise of your own. Ultimately, it's the way that you grow which will determine how or whether you achieve economic freedom. By avoiding the common fallacy that bigger must be better, it allows you to grow in a way that is smarter and consistently pushes you closer to a future of wealth, time, and freedom. Action item. Shift your business paradigms to grow smart instead of big. Avoid the trap that many entrepreneurs fall into where growing revenue eats up your time until you have no time left to do anything but work. Always remember that economic freedom is achieved when you have both money and time. One without the other will be of little use in helping you achieve your goals.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own. And if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.